This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They are recognizing we're involved in the youth and we're listening to them. But also there are invisible strings that are being pulled of neocolonialism for a country like mine.
That's Ugandan climate justice activist Amira Kubusenge saying decision makers need to make good on their promises ahead of the COP28 environmental summit. Details coming up. Also, observers say Zimbabwe's elections were marred by irregularities and intimidation of voters. And French President Emmanuel Macron says his ambassador to Niger is still there despite an ultimatum from the new army leaders to leave. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
At the Secretariat.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been re-elected for a second and final 5-year term in results announced over the weekend. Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa and his party, the Citizens Coalition for Change, have rejected the election results. International election observers said the vote did not meet international standards and was conducted in a climate of fear. In contrast, the observer team from the Southern Africa Development Community said voting was peaceful. For more perspective, VOA's Pauline Diho spoke to Henry Mugzi, the African Elections Observer Network coordinator based in Kampala, Uganda.
At the Secretariat of the African Election Observers Network, we have already branded it a zombie election. We think it does not have any, does not tick any box that qualifies it to be otherwise. We have also gone ahead and said and called on African nations to wake up. Because if you look at the regime that is conducting this election in Zimbabwe, the regime that is headed by President Mnangagwa is a military regime because, you know, its foundation is a coup d'etat. And you cannot expect democracy from a regime whose process, which was constituted through a very undemocratic process.
You just alluded to the fact that this is a regime, therefore meaning that it's a regime that came in by other means necessary other than an election. But the last time I checked, Mnangagwa was duly elected president of Zimbabwe. And
so
he has a legitimate right to run for re-election.
If you look at how he comes into force, the military takes over and puts him there. It means therefore he's a figurehead of the military. And we still think that the military in Zimbabwe has a very big say in how ZANU-PF is being run. If you look at the tendencies, the conduct, the behavior, the captivity of state institutions, you just see the military at play. And therefore, we think he's a front of the military. But behind the face, Mnangagwa, is the militaristic regime that took over power through a military coup.
There was a lot of enthusiasm leading to the elections. A lot of young people were excited. People who have not voted were voting for the first time. Millions more are registered to vote. But from what I've seen, a lot of people have characterized this election as not free, fair, or credible.
There was quite a lot of enthusiasm on the part of young people who thought that they turn out and vote so that they can put an end to this regime. And of course, as you saw, many of them were disappointed, disenfranchised, because they reached the polling stations and polling materials would not be delivered. In some places, they were delivered 10 hours late. In the rural areas, there were disinformation. There was disinformation because, as we understand now, that ZANU-PF placed desks that were conducting exit interviews. And they were told that ZANU has a way of knowing who has voted because they can sequence and know the timings they've gone to the polling station.
If what you're saying is true or has a semblance of truthness to it, then that amounts to intimidation, voter intimidation.
We have recorded, if you read the preliminary statements of many of the international observation missions, the SADC observation mission, the African Union observation mission, the European Union as well. They have all alluded to the intimidation that was out there. They've alluded to the voter suppression. They have alluded to issues of the delays that disenfranchise the voters. They have also alluded to the to other forms of intimidation that was extended to the citizen observers themselves. After this election, it will be difficult for many organizations out there in Zimbabwe to stick their necks out to call themselves election observers, because this is going to have a chilling effect, and this is bound to extend to the other generations that may have an interest in observing elections as citizens of their country.
A coalition of opposition parties in Botswana wants regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to call an emergency meeting to discuss Zimbabwe's disputed election. SADC's observer mission in its preliminary report indicated the election process fell short of local and international standards. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's opposition coalition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, called the Zimbabwe election a sham in a report submitted to SADC Executive Secretary Elias Makhosi. Ditapelo Gyarapetsi, leader of the opposition in parliament, says SADC must act to address concerns over the disputed poll.
We call on SADC to convene an emergency summit of heads of state and government to address the outcome of this discredited, shambolic election, which many commentators describe as the worst in the country's tortured history. In short, there were no elections in Zimbabwe.
Kiorapetsi says SADC should at least call for a rerun of the poll.
The summit should accordingly engage Zimbabwe civil society and all political actors for dialogue with a view to holding new elections which will conform to regional and international standards and the applicable laws of Zimbabwe, including its constitution and electoral laws.
Zimbabwe-based political analyst Effie Lelancube applauds efforts to engage bodies like SADC over the poll dispute.
There must be no stone left unturned to find a resolution to the emerging political crisis born out of the disputed election. If it leads us to the cause, let us go there. If it is SADC, let us go there. If it is the African Union, let us go there.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission announced Sunday that President Emmerson Mnangagwa had 152% of the vote, beating main opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. However, the opposition has since rejected the results after observers cited irregularities. But Mnangagwa told journalists in Harare Sunday he was happy he had won and that the process was free and fair. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
Zimbabweans under the age of 35 are urging incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa and incoming lawmakers to prioritize policies and laws that prioritize youth empowerment in politics and other sectors across the Southern African nation. VOA's Mike Hovey has more.
Zimbabwe's incumbent president, Emmerson Mnangagwa of the ruling ZANU-PF party, has won his second term in office amid growing demands by the nation's youth for economic empowerment and political change. The 80-year-old leader campaigned on several promises, among them development in marginalized areas and empowerment opportunities for youth and women. Tando Gwinji, the managing director of Youth for Innovation Trust, says Zimbabwe's incoming lawmakers should prioritize the inclusion of young people in government and decision-making positions.
As much as youth are there, and they are a majority of the population, but they are not there in terms of representing other youth, especially in public office.
Gwinji's sentiments were echoed by Karen Manzera, a youth activist who says Zimbabwe should scrap its youth parliamentary quota and focus on ensuring that the environment is friendly towards youth empowerment.
With the youth quota, we also need to understand that it coming into being was not youth-driven. It was something that came from the executive, of which when we are having something for the youth, then it should be by the youth.
Cynthia Chigwenya, a Zimbabwean peace activist and African Union youth ambassador, is urging Zimbabwe's lawmakers to ensure there is a fair representation of women and youth in public office.
Young people should not be made to feel that they do not have a stake in politics and governance, because when they don't have a stake, then military coups become a sort of an option for them, because that's one of the ways through which they can be hurt.
Prior to the elections, Zimbabwe's parliament was working towards a policy that allocates 27 parliamentary seats towards youth to satisfy a quota. However, young leaders are calling for more, as they argue the gesture is unsatisfactory because Zimbabweans under the age of 35 represent nearly 68% of the population. Mike Ove, VOA News, Washington.
Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, which has been engaged in a brutal armed conflict with the National Army, has unveiled its political roadmap for resolving both the ongoing and historical conflicts in the nation. The RSF's vision centers around achieving a lasting ceasefire and initiating a process that leads to the establishment of a national army reflecting Sudan's diversity and operating under civilian authority. Additionally, the vision advocates for an inclusive civilian government that ensures the representation of marginalized groups. Nabil Biagio spoke with Salman Mohamed Salman, a Sudanese analyst and the chairman of the University of Khartoum Council. Salman wrote a book in June titled The Rapid Support Forces, Origins, Expansion, and the Path to the April 2023 War.
The political vision that was issued yesterday, in my view, is a very important step in the 20 years history of the RSF. They started in 2003 as a group of militias, and then they were consolidated in 2007 as Janjaweed, and then in 2013 they were reorganized and put under one group and called the Border Guards, and then in 2013 they were again restructured, and in 2017 the law was passed. That was a major step as them, which made them, with the law, made them a separate independent military unit, almost of equal status to the army. And so this step of the political vision yesterday is really, in my view, a transformation from a militia or a paramilitary group into a political group. It talks about Sudan, starting Sudan reborn, and then the subtitle is a vision for a new state. So it's no longer a militia, it's no longer a paramilitary group, it is now a political group that has a broad vision, and there's a vision for a new Sudan. And this is reminds me of the SPLA, the Sudanese People Liberation Army, led by the late George Gongaran. The program is more or less is quite similar to that program. It's a new Sudan of equality between the different groups, ethnic, religious, with the governance structure and with a clear division of wealth and power. So I see this document really as an attempt to transform RSF from a paramilitary group or militia, into a political group.
And of course, you have a close knowledge of this organization, and you've authored a book on its origins, expansion, and the path to the current war. But in many ways, the statement from yesterday, it reads like a counter-proposal to what the army made. We remember 2 weeks ago, the army had its own proposal, which was announced by Malik Agar, the deputy chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council. How do you compare the two?
Now, it's a huge competition between the two groups to allure civilians. So the statement put together by Malik Agar was talking about the same issues, to a large extent the same issues that are now handled in the vision for a new state by the RSF. The irony of this matter is that this vision was really the vision put together by the revolutionaries since December 2018, which was brutally suppressed by the RSF and SAF. So now they are, each of them is trying to adopt that vision with slight differences. I see the main differences, the main two differences between the RSF vision and the government of Sudan, or the army's vision, as initiated by Malik Agar, is that, but Malik Agar's vision is made it very clear that it's inclusive. Everybody is there, including the National Congress Party, the Islamist group that governed Sudan for 30 years. Whereas RSF vision is clearly made it very clear that the National Congress Party, Islamist, will not be included in any future dialogue.
That's Salman Mohamed Salman, Sudanese analyst and chairman of the University of Khartoum Council. He spoke with Nabil Biagio from the U.S. state of Virginia. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Today is the first day of this year's week-long climate justice camp in Lebanon, where more than 450 young leaders from the world's most climate-affected regions are gathering to strategize and create joint demands of decision-makers ahead of COP28. The camp includes workshops on finance, loss and damage, phasing out fossil fuels, and climate adaptation. VOA's Carol Van Dam talked with two young climate justice advocates at the event, Hamira Kubisenge from Uganda and Fatima Zari Tarib from Morocco. Hamira begins.
I personally, I am an advocate for Stop ECOP, and that is what is happening in my country. And with the fossil fuel treaty, we are trying to get leaders to sign on to the treaty, as many as they can, and to stop production of fossil fuels. But also, while we are demanding for the phase out of fossils and demanding for the stop of ECOP and any further drilling of the ground for fossils, we're also demanding the global north and the richer countries to pay up for, to clear the debt, the climate debt that has been accumulated over the years, but also to make good on the climate finance that have come talking about over these years, and also to put money in the loss and damage facility that was created last year. Because, yes, the facility is there, but there's no money there, and it leaves our countries looking at the only savior as fossils, and leaving our politicians in a state of quagmire where all they have to depend on is the fossils. But on top of that, we should not forget about the loss and damage money, because right now we need the money to be put in the facility for the countries in Africa to actually depend on. But also climate debt should be funded, because every time there's a crisis in my country, for example, we've had floods in recent days and also the landslides last year.
That part of the agreement has been talked about a lot, but there hasn't been concrete unanimous approval of that amongst the countries that are involved, you know, the world leaders. So how do you hope to get that accomplished?
It's, of course, very disappointing when you see countries not agreeing. For example, at Bonn, at the SBs, which is an annual conference that it gets held every year in Germany, we've seen countries not even agreeing on a mitigation point in their agenda to talk about, right? And so when you see this happening, and then you aspire for something more like a loss and damage fund, you kind of lose hope at that time and you feel like it's hopeless and everything. But I think one of the things that people are not aware of when they're out of like the youth space is that we still talk about loss and damage. We still push for it. And not only that, we still push for equitable fossil fuel phase out. We push for these like big words, right? That people are like, oh, this is like radical or whatever. But for us, it's what, you know, what we need for us to have our future.
Scientists have been warning for decades now that this is real, this is happening, and we're at a turning point now. Do you feel that world leaders are listening to young activists like yourselves?
I do think they are, in a way, because, you know, they may not be as ambitious as we want them. They may not do what we want, but, you know, in the last couple of years, we've got the chance to sit with them in tables, to talk, to share points, to even be part of it. I mean, one example that I like to give is the Mexican delegation. They appointed youth as negotiators in their work when they go to climate conferences. And that's like a huge milestone for us to have the power to negotiate what we want.
How do you feel about that? If you were to add your two cents about Uganda, Hamira.
They are tokenizing like, oh, we're involving the youth and we're listening to them. But also there are invisible strings that are being pulled of neocolonialism for a country like mine. Then the invisible strings of France, we owe France this money. We owe this country this money. The World Bank, we owe the World Bank this money. Oh, the World Bank is closing out loaning us this money. We are in a state of, we can't move forward, we can't move backward. We are stuck in one place.
That was young climate activist Hamira Kubisenge from central Uganda and Fatima Zaire Tarib from northern Morocco. Both were talking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from the second annual climate justice camp in Mount Lebanon, just outside of Beirut. While the Islamic State terror group continues to lose influence in Iraq, U.S. Major General Matthew W. McFarlane recently warned that the Islamic State remnants still pose a threat to areas not under the protection of the U.S.-led coalition, including parts of Syria. analysts see Islamic State expanding into Africa and Asia. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
U.S. Major General Matthew W. McFarlane commands the Combined Joint Task Force, Operation Inherent Resolve, based in Iraq, working to defeat Islamic State militants and prevent their resurgence. In an online briefing to journalists this month, McFarlane called the group ISIS, as well as the Arab acronym Daesh, said Islamic State no longer controls any territory, has lost leaders and fighters, and carries out fewer attacks than in the past. He said there was a 65% reduction in Islamic State activity this year compared to last year.
They continue to degrade. Having said that, there are still radical fighters out there that aspire to reemerge or rebuild the caliphate. We work very closely with our Iraqi counterparts. We share intelligence to make sure we address any possible reemergence or any possible threats that emerge from those ISIS fighters that are still at large. We also work to address the long-term efforts like repatriation of IDPs and Daesh detainees that are in the detention facilities in Syria.
Stephen Heidemann, a non-resident senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, told VOA that McFarlane gave a fairly balanced assessment of Islamic State at this time. However, Heidemann points to a recent United Nations report that says the Islamic State group still commands between 5,000 and 7,000 fighters in Syria and Iraq.
There's certainly no sense we can declare mission accomplished in terms of Operation Inherent Resolve. It continues to play an important role in degrading ISIS, and yet ISIS retains the ability to sustain pretty high levels of insecurity in eastern Syria and northwestern Iraq. We can't underestimate the extent to which local groups that publicly affiliate with ISIS have in some ways overtaken the core group as a source of threat. Africa is clearly one arena in which we're seeing that happen.
A South Africa-based analyst, Martin Iwe, has also warned of the growing threat in Africa, where Islamic State is active in more than 20 countries already. He cautioned that the continent may represent the future of the caliphate. Analyst Nicholas Harris at Washington's New Lines Institute tells VOA that Islamic State is like a perennial, dormant in the Middle East heartland, but regenerating and springing to life in Central Asia and Africa.
ISIS has numerous cells in Syria and has also established in that sort of western badlands of Iraq a support network. ISIS has tried to manage the reality that it is a organization that's looking for this opportunity to spring back. The ISIS brand globally has found opportunity to grow in Central Asia, particularly Afghanistan, but also it's looking to spread into Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and is looking to try to take advantage of rising communal religious tensions in India.
Harris said that in Africa, Islamic State is trying to take advantage of the war in Sudan and the destabilization of Ethiopia. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Vasco Volarech, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, today's